I tell you right now, there is absolutely no way that that hunt would have went the way it did had it not been for your podcast and all the guests that you've had on it. It's just a wealth of knowledge. It's unbelievable.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, as you heard in the teaser, we have a special episode tonight. This is an episode somewhat like we've done before in that it's an episode with you, one of our listeners, but this story is unlike anything we've heard. Tonight we talk with Brian Oden. He's an Arkansas guy, just a regular guy, like you, like me, and he wanted to hunt elk. And this is his story about how he did that. It's a story about how the podcast helped him do that. And we say the podcast, we don't mean like us. I don't mean myself. I don't mean Steve. I mean all of the guests that we've had on the show. Because this show really isn't about us. It's about you, the listeners, and it's about the guests that we have. Tonight, the listener is the guest, and I'm super excited to share this one with all of you. Before we dive into that, just wanted to thank you guys, as always, for tuning in. Again, you can contact us anytime by email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. So if you have questions, suggestions, guest requests, anything like that, just let us know. Also, if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else you might be listening to this. Okay, guys, I'm so excited to share this one with you. Let's get straight into it. An awesome elk hunting story with many lessons learned that you can glean from with Brian Oden. Well, Brian, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Very good. Steve, what's going on, buddy?
Living the dream, man. Getting ready for Christmas. Take a little time off work. It's going to be a nice little vacation.
Yeah. Yeah. This is just the week before Christmas as we record this one. So it's pretty exciting time of year. So Brian, let's kick things off. I guess, you know, you are a listener of the podcast. You shot us an email this past fall after your 2017 elk hunt, which of course we want to dive into, and it's an awesome story, and there's some really cool lessons in there, especially for guys who are newer to elk hunting and or guys who don't live out west and kind of want to make that trip happen. I mean, that's your story and that's what we want to hear about tonight. But before we get to the elk hunt itself, kind of give us just a little bit of a personal background or history and context on who you are.
Okay. I live in Arkansas, Northeast Arkansas, a town called Paragould. It's about 30 minutes north of Jonesboro. And we've got about 50,000 people here. I grew up a family guy. I've got two daughters, 14, actually about to turn 15, Christmas Eve. She's a Christmas Eve baby. And then I've got another daughter that is 11. So got two girls. They're kind of interested in hunting just a little bit, but not as much as daddy. Sports keep them pretty busy. And I'm a fireman. I've been a fireman for about 22 years in Jonesboro. And it's really fortunate the way our work schedule works. I actually end up with quite a little bit of time to hunt in the fall. Of course, with kids, you know, time's busy. But my family's usually pretty good about trying to work it around me. But it's good times for sure. Keeps you hopping.
Right. So you mentioned previously it was you were kind of laid up with a back surgery, and was that when you really kind of got the drive to want to make a backcountry hunt or get out west happen? Is that when that happened?
Yeah. Well, I have always wanted to do so, but in 2013, I was fortunate enough to actually make a trip to Alberta, Canada, where we had made some friends up there through a sale of a bow, and ended up going up there and trying our hand at elk hunting. Of course, we were still new to it. It was no different than deer hunting or anything else. We were just going to the woods to spend some time in the bush, as they call it. And anyway, on the way in, we had about a 26-mile ride in, and I actually, we were in a side-by-side, and I broke my ankle going in. I didn't realize that I did. I thought it was sprained pretty bad. But over the course of the next 10 days, it didn't get a whole lot better, but I was able to bear weight. Went ahead and hunted through it, came back, found out it was actually broken. And then through the process of limping for 10 days and coming back and getting on crutches, changing my gait two or three times, I think that progressed a back injury maybe to the point where I actually herniated a disc. And so it was kind of, my wife wants to call it cause and effect. It's because I went to camp and some other stuff happened. But yeah, it was, ended up coming up with a ruptured disc pretty bad. It was going to need surgery. And it was the week about, I guess about 10 days before Thanksgiving. And so I was laid up in bed for about 11 or 12 days, just waiting on the surgeon, to get back in town to where he could take care of me. And of course, you know, you lay up like that, that time of year, you can get in pretty bad place. And yeah, you started trying to find something to occupy my time, something that I can. I'm a planner. I like adventure. I like to I like the next thing to do. And you know, we get out around here a lot, and I've made some trips out to West Arkansas, some, like I said, some pretty rugged remote areas. But it kind of spawned an idea and started kind of looking around and trying to find some information. Of course, it's hard to find information when you're laid up in bed, but I did do a kind of a Google search and started on YouTube. And when I started typing in backcountry hunting and backpack hunting, actually your video that you had just posted, I believe just a couple weeks earlier, was actually the first link that popped up. And it just kind of started the, I thought, you know what, I could do that. That's something I'd like to work towards. So it kind of occupied my time, gave me something to focus on instead of laying there feeling sorry for myself. So
yeah, that's wild. I see how it is. You're looking at this video and going, if this idiot can pull it off, certainly I can do it.
No, it, you know, like no. I said, you just having a place to start, because as we'll, I'm sure we'll get to, it's real easy to put everything in a pack. And you can overload it so much, and it's nice to hear to people's experience to kind of lay everything out there, and kind of it just gives you a good evaluation, a good starting point of what you need, what you don't need, what's convenience, what's you know, what you have to have. So it was very very insightful, and it actually, like I said, gave me a starting place. So I started breaking it down and kind of trying to figure out all of it. So
that was 3 or 4 years before this fall and the hunting story that we'll talk about. Did you kind of try and do some backcountry hunting or more remote hunting there in Arkansas? Because as you mentioned, there are some actually pretty good remote areas there. Did that change your stunt hunting style in the past few years where you're at?
Yes, it did. It really did. Which the public land, we're fortunate. Arkansas has got a lot of public land, but we've also got a lot of public land hunters. But just like anywhere else, of course, on a much smaller scale than out west, if you put in a little bit of time and trouble, a little bit of effort, you can usually get away from the norm, from the majority of people. And typically, the people that are going to put forth the effort to get back there, and I say back there, I'm talking 2 or 3 miles deep, typically they don't hurt you because they're after the same goal. And people that work that hard typically, you know, they're kind of like-minded, so they're not interested in messing anybody up any more than we are. So, but it did, it kind of, it got the wheels to turning. I started putting together my kit, so to speak, with stuff I had in my pack, and wanted to kind of test it out. Just my wife would laugh at me. I'd go out and I'd throw up a little, you know, a floorless shelter or something in the yard when it was really cold, and try to a base layer and a sleeping bag, and just see kind of tweak it around a little bit. But you know, like I said, it's hard sometimes to get in that situation, but you gotta put yourself out there for sure.
Yeah, that's so good. I think, I mean, that's such a good takeaway of you just got to start with what you have and where you're at. And for so many folks, it's, you know, if you're not trying stuff and testing, you know, both gear and mind and body and just even remoteness of hunting, like, it might not be the ultimate goal of where you want to be in terms of a big hunt, but man, just start doing what you can where you're at with what you have. That's good.
Well, and you hit on it there. Heavy emphasis on the mind and body. You know, you've referenced it. You and Steve both have referenced it many times in your podcast and stuff about You know, it's easy to quit. It's easy to, and I think you'd actually mentioned that you actually had a letter or a photo or something from your daughter that when you start getting out there and things start going south or not like you want to, that little memento that brings you back to home kind of re-energizes you for a couple of days. And you know, you stay after, you remember where you were in July with mm-hmm. a pack on your back and 100 degrees and now you're here and this is what it's about. So you know, stay the course and hopefully things work out for the best.
So let's fast forward and really talk about not starting the hunt this year, but how did this year's hunt come together for you? I know you found a partner, you found somebody from back home who's willing to take this type of adventure and endeavor on. How did that go? How did you meet him? How did you find him? Because that's something we get questions of on quite a bit is, you know, how do you find a hunting partner? What do you look for in a hunting partner? Or,
right.
You know, I live, you know, nowhere near elk country. I can't find anybody crazy enough or passionate enough or stupid enough to go with me. How did that work out for you?
Well, like I said, it started here. It started in Arkansas, wanting to get just a couple miles in and kind of doing some remote stuff. And when we hunt down here, you know, we've got some good bucks, but we don't have anything like the Midwest and as far as the numbers. I mean, I've been blessed enough. I've killed some nice deer on public land, but to really get in there, it was more about the adventure than it was anything. And I've got some very, very dear friends that I hunt with, spend a lot of time hunting with. And actually, the guy that I usually hunt the most with, he's a farmer. And of course, September's boom time for them. They're getting crops out of the fields and it just wasn't going to work out. And we had just kind of been working toward this and trying to get things lined up. And I actually go to church with a gentleman we started going to church 3 or 4 years ago. I got to be really close to him and his family. And he had been out west before and he kind of had that he had the taste in his mouth. So we started talking about this and kind of diving into it. And next thing you know, we thought, let's just do it. And so we started looking around and again, that's the bad thing about being from this part of the country and not out west. It's so hard to find people to get your hands on gear, to try gear, to touch and get a sense of exactly what you are, because hindsight being what it is, a lot of the stuff that I've got, it's good stuff, but might not have been my first choice. So, you know, if you're trying to get geared up for this, before you make that investment, especially on big ticket items, packs and sleeping bags and stuff like that, try to find somebody to, you know, you can get hands on and talk to people, one-on-one. A lot of my gear, like I said, it worked out great. But it's one of those things that, had I touched some other stuff, then I probably would have made some different decisions. But when I started talking to Chris about this trip, he was all in, just right off the bat. We started talking about states and draw odds and you know, we're both blue collar workers. So, we were trying to find something fairly economical and, you know, Idaho has a very liberal tag system, over the counter tags for most of the places, and the prices are real reasonable. And it's a long drive out there, but it's definitely worth the effort for sure. That's kind of where we ended up deciding we were going to try to head there the following year. That would have been from 2016 is when we actually started talking about it, and we just from that point we just kind of had it set in our minds that's what we're going to work toward, and so kind of made a list and started going down it.
Yeah. Steve, remind me to edit that Idaho part out, because I know you don't want that word getting out. we'll overdub that with some other state.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's
put
a
in, like, Florida in there or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Was that like, I mean, that's got to be close to 30 hours for you guys?
Yeah, it was about 31 out there for sure. It was a long drive, but you know, as you head out that way, every 100 miles you click off, you get a little bit closer to something different that you've never seen. I've never been out west, much past Oklahoma, so it was really an enjoyable trip. It was a hard trip, and of course we didn't want to miss anything, so we drove through the night the first time, and our intention was to make it to I believe it was Red Rock, Wyoming, about an hour, hour and a half this side of Salt Lake City. And we wanted to take a rest and sleep through the night, so we're not driving through beautiful scenery or anything else. We want to take it all in.
So you pick a state. How did you guys personally, and obviously we don't need to say where you hunted by any means, but how did you guys pick from Arkansas, driving 30 hours to a place you've never been, that you've never seen? How did you begin to narrow down where you wanted to hunt, like where you were going to choose a trailhead, what access, what you were looking for? Because, I mean, clearly we've talked about e-scouting in the podcast, but I'm curious from your perspective, having walked through this process, what types of things were you looking for? How did you make those decisions?
The first thing we looked at, like I said, was availability. How easily were we actually going to be able to get to some land that maybe wouldn't just be flooded with other hunters? You know, you hear Colorado's a really popular state, but you also hear a lot of people that go to Colorado. And it honestly seemed like Idaho was not quite as popular, not quite as busy in all things considered. And like I said, we weren't looking for anything giant. We were looking for an adventure. So when we started looking at Idaho, and we actually looked at some other stuff, but ultimately it came down to the bottom line, because trying to prepare for a hunt monetarily, as well as you know, logistically, from the cost of the tags and the expense of travel and everything else, we were trying to keep that bottom line just as low as we could. And two, I've read some stuff back to when I was in the bed in 2013. I was actually doing some looking, and hunting up north in the Yukon and Alaska had always just intrigued me. And some of the articles and stuff that I'd come across about the wilderness areas, and actually that they had fly-in drop bases in the wilderness areas, and just the thought of that much open space that was that remote, man, it just, Idaho stuck in my head. And in some pictures, I do a lot of photography, and man, when you look, a lot of my friends would come back from other states, Colorado and Utah, beautiful stuff, but just the man, it, I don't know, it's just one of those things that when you look at a picture and you see Idaho, the lakes and the mountains, it's just that's what was drawing. That was the biggest thing that was drawing. And when we started looking at maps, listening to podcast, introduction of Elk 101 with Corey Jacobson, just a wealth of information, a wealth of knowledge. Chris and I both subscribed, and man, we were eating it up. We were looking, and I've always been a map guy. I like to stay on a map. I like to spend a lot of time and, you know, put myself in the map, so to speak, and kind of, you know, you get on Google Earth and you can go down to almost street level and you can get an idea of the topography and the terrain. And we kept looking, and so much of that is so overwhelming. Coming from a state that has several mountains that are in the, and I laugh when I say mountains, because they're the 1600, 1800, 2000 foot mountains, you know, but they can get pretty steep, but it's, again, it's nothing like out west. It's hard for us to put into perspective exactly what we're getting ourselves into. So we started looking and doing the Elk 101 and kind of breaking it down and looking at some of the things that we needed to concern ourselves with. And in doing so, we narrowed it down to a few different places. I was fortunate enough, through where I work, we have a FDIC. It's in Indianapolis. It's a fire department instructors conference that I attended a few years ago. And I actually attended with some guys from Idaho. And I reached out to them trying to figure out exactly who it was I had attended with. I'm terrible with names. And through the process of talking to one of those guys out there, basically I just leveled with him. I said, hey, we've never been out there. We're not looking for you to tell us a spot, but would you be open to me giving you our plan A, B, and C, and you either confirming or denying that we're on the right track? I wanted to do the work. I wanted to do the map work and the research, and he was gracious enough to do so. And, we're trying to decide dates, trying to decide if we would be ahead to maybe come out there with a rifle and really maximize our opportunity. But at the same time, I'm a very avid bow hunter, and so was Chris. So we decided we liked the idea of the up close and personal and trying to get it done with the bow. And we gave the gentleman I spoke with out there three or four options, and he's like, "Yeah, no, I wouldn't worry about the first one. And the second one, yeah, it might be okay, but you might be kind of limited in access. The third one, you're getting pretty close. I think you'll do pretty good there." And he was trying to help me narrow down just into zones that encompassed, maybe four or five different zones. So he wasn't giving us a lot of information, but at the same time, he was able to try to, I guess, kind of confirm some of my hunches and some of my research. And once we finally got it narrowed down, a couple more phone calls, bounced a few more ideas off of him, and he ended up saying that we had two or three plans that were spot on, that he would not hesitate to go in there and try it out. And just through, like I said, through trial and error and process of elimination, and that's the biggest thing is I encourage anybody to reach out. And like I said, you can't expect anybody to give you their spots. But there's, sportsmen, if they're in it for the right reasons, they're more than willing to help people and kind of help themselves, so to speak.
I was just out of curiosity, what dates did you end up picking? And then kind of what was your research behind those dates?
When we started talking about, Corey had mentioned in one of his podcasts, this trifecta of sorts, that when the fall moon, with the fall equinox and all this stuff was supposed to line up, that the perfect dates, there were several people actually that I'd heard through the course of time talk about these, September 10th, 12th, 15th in there was just supposed to be phenomenal this year. And so it kind of worked out. We were both able, my schedule with work is pretty flexible, as is Chris's. So we just kind of, picked a couple weeks slot out there, penciled it in, and that's what we were shooting for.
Okay.
Yeah. It's neat that like you said, you guys did the work. You weren't asking for a handout. You weren't saying, even point me in the right direction. You did a ton of work, and then you're kind of just looking to confirm those plans. And for, a listener who's out there who says, that's all well and good, but I don't have the guy in Idaho that I can call and bounce those ideas off with, or the guy in whatever state, I would take that exact same approach and then do all the work, do the legwork that you did, come up with plans, come up with ABCD. I would do that same exact thing and then call the state fish and game, call somebody from those areas in that state and do the same thing, because I can guarantee you that if you do that work up front and then take that information to somebody like in the fish and game department, for example, that you can actually get some really helpful feedback on, okay, yeah, here's your ABCD, but actually out of all those things, like C looks the best. Maybe here's why. Here's maybe what your plan B should be. So again, even if you guys don't have that resource to talk to you on the ground in terms of somebody, that's still the process that is incredibly valuable, I think.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. In Idaho, and I've even noticed about several of the places, they have spreadsheets and harvest results. I went through probably a couple of different reams of paper, analyzing all this stuff. And we were trying to decide if we wanted to try to overlap the mule deer season with the elk season. And if, to maximize, if we're going to drive 30 hours and spend the money, do we want to maximize our opportunities? And we ended up settling just pretty much on elk. We were going to dive full bore into that. But just hammering out maps and looking at harvest data from years past and trends and declines and, the Onyx maps, that's another unbelievable resource that since I've gotten back from Iowa, I've actually bought a couple of the other states that I hunt around here close, and it allows you to see burned areas, historical burn data, private land, just access points from public side, state side. It's just a wealth of information that it's just as simple as a click. So it's definitely a good place to start. It allows you to really kind of get into it and look at several different angles of the same piece of property.
Yeah, Cool. So you guys get out, make the 30-hour drive, get to the trailhead, start loading up, take off. What's the game plan from the trailhead? Are you guys loaded up with X days worth of gear? You know what direction you're going? Kind of how did that, what was the plan, and then how did it play out? Did it go according to plan?
Yep. When we drove out there, I actually had a plan A, B, and C, and D. And our intention was to basically pack up and take a 2 or 3 day loop and then come back to base camp. We were going to utilize base camp more than anything as a peace of mind, just a reassurance that if things go south, we've got something set up, it's dry, it should be there. And, you know, we can, if we need to get back and regroup or restock, or if we didn't take enough or too much, it was going to give us just a peace of mind. So we had our timed out to where we were going to make, three day loops about, and then the last day we just kind of go for broke and just do whatever we needed to, whether it was 2 or 4 or 5 days or whatever. So we drove out, the first plan, we pulled up in camp, threw a tent on the ground. And I'm going to say we were probably there less than 45 minutes. And we were packs on the back, and we were heading out. We had a trail that we had kind of drawn out on a map that was going to allow us a pretty easy purchase into the wilderness, but it wasn't a trail. It was a bushwhack. But maps and some aerial data that I'd looked at looked like it was going to be, I'm not going to say easy walking, but very doable. And our goal was to make it on top of the mountain before dark, and hopefully maybe hear something at dark, you know, spend the night out there with them, just see, kind of see what we hear. More than anything, it was get out of the truck, get in the woods. We drove this way. Let's get this thing going. So we made it to camp, had it set up there. The pack weight, it's easy to load way too much stuff in that pack. Holy cow. And it's funny because as we were making the mountain there, 2 or 3 different times, as I propped my head up on my walking sticks, I thought, you know, and I remember hearing Steve talk about, you know, these 20 and 25 pound packs. And I'm like, there's no way. But then I was about ready to dump my stuff in the woods for sure.
Yeah. I think once you go through that once, you'll freaking, you're going to learn from it fast, basically, and get pack lighter.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, coming from Arkansas, just the sheer size of the world out there. It's just, it's beyond comprehension until you stand there and you look. I took gobs of pictures and they don't do them justice. They don't begin to touch, how big it is. And, you know, when you take off walking up, we had done a lot, to condition. I'd started actually packing, 40, 50, 60 pound packs a day or two a week, at a place just north of here. You got some, a little bit of steep topography, but not much, but just trying to get my legs under. I mean, we did that from March right up into the time we left, and we were pretty decently conditioned. And we were, our elevation was not that bad. We were in that 5,800 to 6,500 mark. And I never really felt like I had any issues with it that first afternoon. Buddy was a little winded, but we weren't exactly sure what it was. If it was just the mental fatigue and, you know, driving so far and jumping out and jumping straight to it, or, cause we hit it pretty hard after having basically set for 2 days. But we got up, got camp set up, and right at dark, just about as far as you could think you could possibly hear something, I thought I heard a chuckle, just the tail end of a bugle and chuckle, and just enough to, you know, say, hey, we're going to hit the sack and it's going to be a good day tomorrow. But it was pretty quiet through the night, but that's, our plan the next morning was to get up and kind of continue our loop.
Yeah. So is that what you did? Did you hear anything in the morning? How did the next day go for you?
The next morning, the day before, as we were going up the mountain, we were seeing a lot of tracks a lot of droppings and some rubs, but they all seem to be going in one general direction, and that was further in. I had remembered reading some stuff about a potential migration route that they, as they come from the river breaks and head to the lower elevations. After we got up that morning and we had worked our way probably a mile and a half, it was apparent, it seemed like we were behind everything. All the tracks were going pretty much the same direction. We weren't hearing anything, just taking in the scenery. Once we hit about almost 2.5, probably a little over 2.5 miles, we kind of came to the realization that we need to take a reality check. We've got 45-50 pound packs. Are we prepared to get something out further than this? So we actually abandoned our first plan, and we started hunting back toward camp. We're going to try to regroup, try to reanalyze and chuck some weight out of the packs, and just kind of take a deep breath and slow down. And that, now we're here, we're in the woods. Now let's get serious. And that's the biggest thing. I think it's so easy to kind of get the big eye and think that your capabilities are one thing. But we didn't waste any time in identifying our limitations, stopping and regrouping and trying to adapt and not waste our time being miserable, basically.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely, yeah, smart move, yeah.
Right. It's such a key point, especially, I mean, and we're, there's just so much out there about, you know, let's go in deep, let's get away from the crowds, let's be 5-6 miles, and man, you don't have to do that. And I'll tell you what, dude, the first bull I packed out was 6+ miles at some serious elevation, and I do not wish that on anybody, especially for the first pack out. I mean, it's so wise of you guys to take that approach, and I just want to reinforce that for the listeners for sure.
Well, I think so much of that allure, especially for us not being out there, the allure, you grow up watching these Western hunting shows and all these things, and it's like, man, I want to do that. I can do that. But man, it takes a special type individual. It's a lot of hard work. It's not something you can go out there. I don't care if you're into CrossFit, if you're a runner, it's just different. It's until you put legs on the ground and weight on your back and trudge a mountain, it's eye-opening for sure.
Yeah. As you guys headed back, and you kind of mentioned you wanted to lighten the packs for heading back out further, what are some of the things that you dropped from the pack that you realized you may or may not didn't need?
Well, you listened to Lenny and Steve and yourself, and you start talking, well, you know, you don't need a spare light. Basically the first thing we did, we dropped all of our spares. We had spare batteries. We had spare lights. We had, there was some stuff that we had that was duplicate. We had tried to, I would carry a cook set, and he would carry a stove, and his son would carry a fuel bottle. And we were going to try to, we tried to do that even more. But honestly, we also decided that, we were conditioned to the point where we could get in pretty easy a couple miles in a day. So instead of doing the deep back country hunt, we decided to start, trying to do just a full long day, take the bare necessities. If we decided, got out there and we had to spend the night, throw a tarp in there, a little extra food. But I'm going to say I probably cut out a good 25-30 pounds out of my pack just and didn't think twice.
So you're kind of going out on more of a day hunt, but with the necessities of if you get out there and have to stay, you can.
Right, exactly. We didn't want to get out there and just get to something, and then it start to get too dark on us, and then have to back out only to come back to the same point just to start the next morning.
Right.
That's the point where I really started trying to recall some of the stuff that Paul Medell, the elk nut, had started talking about, and as a matter of fact, I think one of the last podcast that we listened to, I don't know, it was 92, 93. He was back on there and he was talking about that, you know, the majority of their stuff, they didn't have very far pack outs. They hunted not from the road, but they hunted access from the road daily, to where they didn't do a lot of overnight time in the actual woods, as far as spending the night and stuff like that. So we were just at this point, we were trying to look for options. We were trying to devise a couple plans that would kind of facilitate our abilities more, try to work it, you know, a little bit friendlier.
Yeah. Well, as we've hinted at, this hunt worked out for you. So begin to take us to the encounter that you had, and then ultimately walk us through that story. But it wasn't too much longer after you guys came back to camp and circled back. Was it this next day that you guys went out that you really got into the bulls?
Yeah. When we came out, it would be the second night. We came back out. We were interested. We had to drive about an hour or so to be able to get service to call the families. Like I said, I had a wife and two girls that were just, they were chomping at the bit to hear from me, and I was probably more so to hear from them. So we drove the hour out, and I remember Paul talking about, you know, that they, at nighttime, they would drive around and they would actually bugle from the road and just see what they would hear. And so, you know, I thought, well, studying my topography maps and stuff, I found three or four different drainages that this hour-long drive would take us through, and it would allow us to some had trailheads, some didn't, but it would allow us easy access to where if by chance we did hear something, then we could get on the trailhead or start at the access there and then work our way kind of uphill, and that would allow us for a downhill return. So we made it to town, called the families on our way back in. We stopped at one drainage that I felt and hoped actually offered the best opportunities because of the way it laid. It had a lot of the north facing slopes and some of the what they call darker timber that stays a little cooler, and it had some pretty easy access comparatively speaking. And we pulled up and we shut the truck off, and I walked. Actually had to walk down the hill and kind of away from a creek a little bit so I could hear, and I let out just a location bugle, and he cut me off. He answered me right back, and of course that's just we went from zero to hero right there. I mean, it was you couldn't hardly convince me there was an elk in the woods, and now all of a sudden, holy cow, it's starting to play out. It's real. We're playing the game. Now we've got a response. We can't do anything with him tonight, but we know that there's a bull somewhere in this basin not far from us right now. So each basin we stopped at three or four times over the next hour back to camp, we stopped and called and we didn't hear anything else. And man, we were so pumped up. This was awesome. We were elk hunting now. We've heard them answer us back. So the next morning, the wind was not like we thought, not like we'd hoped. So we went ahead and started with our original plan B, but we tried to break about an hour and a half into the woods before sunrise and to get to a vantage point and listening point. And it was cold and windy, and it was nothing like what we expected. I would have been very surprised. I felt like we were probably more likely to see a mountain goat up there than we were elk. It was pretty barren. It looked like it had burned maybe the year before, and it looked pretty, but it was not what we expected. So we were trying to decide. We were afraid to go into that first basin where we'd heard the elk bugle the night before because the wind was wrong, and that's a kind of a story in itself. The whole time we were up there, coming from Arkansas, big whitetail hunter, we concentrate so much on the wind, and we just don't want our wind to blow across our bedding areas or where we think the potential animals are. And that actually kind of bit us a couple times, because we weren't looking at the small picture. We were looking at the big picture and couldn't see the forest for the trees. And when we finally decided that we weren't where we wanted to be, we thought, you know what, it's an hour out Let's go ahead and break camp. Let's get down there to where we know an elk's at, and let's start from there. Let's start. This is day. We'll start it like day one, and we'll see what happens. So we relocated, got our camp set up. Couldn't wait to get in the woods because we know that there was an elk right here, less than 200 yards from us. And we worked our way in a little bit, slipping because you know he's got to be right there. And the wind was wrong, and we were getting frustrated because we couldn't get the wind right. And what we ultimately decided about the wind, instead of worrying about the wind, not knowing where the elk is, don't worry about it. Get in the woods, get out there, make noise, get something going, and then move to let the wind fit the situation. Because if you go at it straight on, hoping for the perfect wind, you're not going to get it. Well, you don't get it in Arkansas, and you sure don't get it out there in the mountains. So just take the individual opportunity and kind of set up for the wind the way it was.
How did you make a play then? As you decided to move, what was the strategy for actually getting in there? Did you move in? Did you wait and call from a distance? How did this play out?
We wanted to get a little bit of distance in the woods before we started calling. And as soon as we felt like we were in close proximity to where that bull had been, just pretty close to sunset, a little after the night before, we didn't think he'd probably come that far. We were hunting. We were calling, and we were bugling and cow calling, just trying to get a response. We were just working our way down the side of the shelf and just listening high, listening low, just taking in the scenery, trying to get some distance in the woods. And we heard a bugle. I was actually off looking off this rock face just to see what was out there. And I came back and my buddy said, "Hey, did you hear that?" I'm like, "No." He said, "Well, elk bugled right down here." So we kind of scrambled there and we kind of tried to get set up on him. And Chris's son, he's his 17-year-old son, he went out there with us kind of as a last-minute idea. He wanted to go. He's in phenomenal condition shape. So he had a pack and he was with us, and we were set up hoping this bull would come in. Heard him bugle a couple more times, and it fell apart just as quick as it started. We don't really know what happened to him. I don't believe he winded us. But like I said, this particular day, the wind had shifted from the north. The temperature had started dropping. It had dropped probably, I'm going to say, 25, 30 degrees over the last day and a half. And it felt like things were about to, it's a feeling. When you're in the woods a long time, when the wind and the temperature and everything gets right, it just feels right. So the elk that we heard bugling, he kind of fell apart, and we sat there and we started trying to decide our next plan. And that's kind of when we came to the realization that, you know, we can't play the wind for what we don't know. We've got to wait until we hear an elk, and then we just adjust to that elk, whatever we need to do. So we heard another elk bugle off in the distance, 200-300 yards away, and we started trying to figure out what we're going to do, how we're going to make our play. And in the process, we got up, gathered our stuff up, and before we could take off after this elk, we heard another elk, and he bugled, I'm going to say, probably 100 yards from us, and it would have been off to our north, off to our right. And of course, he's a lot closer, so now he becomes the object of all our attention, and it gets pretty crazy from that point. It's an awesome story for sure.
Let's dig into it, man. I've read it. I'm like, dude, even reading it, I was super excited. So yeah, just walk us through it, because it's so cool how this plays out.
Okay, so Chris, we had drawn straws, and it was our turn. It was my turn to shoot that day. And as we set up for this elk, he was responding. Every time we'd bugle, he'd holler right back at us with the bugle. He'd cut us off. And it wasn't very aggressive, but it was more of a location bugle with just a little bit of extra stuff in it. We'd cow call and he'd bugle. And we'd bugle and he'd bugle. So we're like trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen here. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, he's not getting any closer. And he actually may be getting away from us just a little bit. And it's really thick. We're boxed in. A long shot would be 20 yards. So we're trying to figure out what to do. I turkey hunt quite a bit here. I've learned that if you call in a turkey and he leaves, he's not coming back. And there's a lot of similarities from what I'm seeing with elk and turkeys in the way that you can't necessarily call them down a hill because they can see where you should be. So this elk's over here bugling, and I look at Chris, and after about 20 minutes, I said, man, I said, I'm going after him. So I dropped my pack, grabbed my rangefinder, which I know everybody says don't drop your pack, but I knew they were going to stay there, so hopefully this was going to work out. So I grabbed my rangefinder, my binocular harness, and I took off. And went about 10 or 15 foot, and it was thick, trying not to spook anything, and I got to this creek. When I got down the creek, went to cross it, and the far side was probably about 6 or 7 foot tall, and it was just laced with sticks and twigs and debris from looked like maybe a flood, I'm not sure. And I thought, there's no way that I can crawl up this thing because this elk is bugling 40 yards across the creek. So anyway, I took my time, moved some sticks, got to the top of the hill. I could see movement, but that's all. It was so thick, there's no way I could even tell for sure that was the elk that was bugling. So I started working my way, just tippy-toeing, and as he would move, he was still moving up the hill away from us. So we continued. Chris is calling across the creek, and the elk's still bugling, but he's still moving away from us. So fast forward about 20 minutes. I'm still with the elk. We're now probably 100, 150 yards away from the creek. He's still bugling, and I'm trying to figure out. He doesn't know why I'm here. So I'm getting closer and closer to him, but there's still too much distance between us. So I finally get to a vantage point. I get a little bit ahead of him, and I feel like he's going to cross in front of me, and I can't find him. And then all of a sudden, I look up at the top of the hill, and I see a tree just shaking. And I'm thinking, I was trying to make out exactly what I was seeing, and the elk was rubbing on the tree. So I'm trying to figure out my plan. I start trying to move on him, and I chicken out a couple times. I think, man, he's going to bust me. And so I actually peeled out to take a few steps and ended up retreating because I was just nervous. I was afraid I was going to get busted. Anyway, I thought, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to cow call. I'm going to stick my head behind this big tree, and I'm going to try to throw my sound and see if I can get a response. Well, like I said, he's probably 75 yards up the hill. So I cow call real softly. Well, I get a bugle, except it about knocks my hat off. This bugle came not from 75 yards, but this bugle came from 40 yards. And I couldn't see him, but there was actually two elk. There was two elk. They were both bugling. I couldn't see the second elk, but the other elk turned and bugled. And then the elk that just bugled at me bugled. And now they're going back and forth at each other. And so the elk that was the furthest away starts on a straight line coming toward the elk, kind of coming toward me. Well, this is it. I couldn't believe it was happening. So now I'm within, 75, 80 yards of not one, but two elk. And when I finally see them, they look like identical twins. They were nice framed up bulls. They were young, 5x5, 6x6s. Mine was just, it barely made a 6x6 by a couple, but just a inch split on his back tines there. So they sit there and they size each other up. The next thing you know, they lock antlers and they start pushing back and forth. And it wasn't just a big brawl, but they were growing quite tired of each other. And I was just in awe. Here we are in Idaho, and I'm watching these elk lock up and push around on each other, and still too far for a shot. I'm getting to the point where it's about to get open enough, but there was just where I was. So I start trying to make a play. And each time they'd lock antlers and I could hear that, then I would move. And if it was stop, I would stop. So I'm moving along, and I actually closed probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 yards on them. And then all of a sudden I hear this sound, and it echoes in my mind. And if you're a whitetail hunter, when you hear a doe blow at you, it sends chills down your spine because the jig's up. Well, as soon as I heard it, I knew what it was. I had downloaded the Elk Nut app. And it was the nervous grunt. It was that I want to call it a bark, but Paul said that, when you hear that, that doesn't necessarily mean they're scared, but they want you to identify yourself. It's requiring an action. And I froze. I didn't know what to do. And I look up, and one of the bulls is, he's actually leaving. He's actually going away from me. And the other one's just standing there. Well, he barks at me again, and I'm like, what? What am I going to do? I'm shaking, and I'm like, what? Holy cow. So what did Paul say? Well, when you hear that, he's asking for an action. So I ask an action of him. So the best I could, I gave him a nervous grunt, and he did exactly what I asked him to. He took 3 or 4 steps out, and he looked at me, and he barked at me again. And I thought, holy cow, it actually worked. But now what am I going to do? Because he's honored my request, and now I have to honor his. And I lean out and I range, and it's about 80, probably 80 yards or so. And I thought, you know, I've got to get closer. So I thought, I'm busted. I don't know what's going to happen here. And I start going through my mind what to do. And Paul says that when you hear that nervous grunt, give them what they're asking for. So I lowered my head. I got my cow call, and I started cow calling softly as I tried to stay obscured as I walked about 10 or 12 yards directly toward that elk. I always tried to keep something between me and the elk, but I was cow calling. So he was seeing movement. He was hearing a cow, and I got up there about another 10 or 12 yards closer, and I thought, holy cow, this actually worked. Well, he barked at me again, and he seems like he's starting to get aggravated because he can't really make out what I am. So I thought, well, I'm going to do it again. So I walked another 10 yards or so, and cow calling the whole way, and he's just standing there just waiting for me to show up on his doorstep. And I get to a point where I lean out and I range the tree directly in front of him. And I think, man, I can do that. I can make that shot. So I draw my bow back, I settle my pins, and I start cow calling, and I walk upright out from behind my tree about 3 steps until my lane is clear. I settle my pin on the bull, and he stands there and eats that arrow like a champ. The arrow buried into the fletching. I hit him perfect. He took off, and when I saw my arrow bury up, I knew exactly where I'd hit him. I'd hit him. I was probably 4 or 5 inches behind his shoulder, right at the break of where his side rolls down to his chest. Of course, I was a really steep angle. He was probably 30, 35 degrees above me. So I hit him good. And man, I melted. I like to fell apart because I thought, holy cow, who would have ever thought you could have walked 25 yards toward an elk with him looking at you? And, you know, it's Paul made mention of when they hear that, they're requesting an action. They want you to stop. They want you to show yourself. Well, he heard an elk and he saw movement. And I think that's why I was able to get by with stepping out there to shoot it. He wasn't surprised to see something. And, you know, good camouflage. And, it was able to work out. Holy cow.
Yeah, dude, that's so amazing. Like, what a cool way for that to go down. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. It's so surreal.
When you stepped out, he was facing you. He was looking, but he wasn't. His body wasn't towards you. You still had a decent angle at his vitals.
He was perfectly broadside, and the first time or two he had done that nervous grunt, he had actually walked a couple steps down the hill, and there was a deadfall that he was behind. And when he got to that, he turned sideways. I don't know, to walk around it, to walk away, but he stopped, and he was perfectly broadside. And man, it was, I went down the hill. I was going to give him some time. Went down the hill, got Chris, told him the story, man, got to the details. And it was just, I couldn't hardly believe it. Just telling it how it happened. And you know, that's something, having never been out there, having never elk hunted, formally before, that's something you would never try. That's not something that you just, common sense tells you not to do that. But when you can take something and get some information from the podcast and from Paul and from Corey and all these different guys that live it, they do it. You know, to be able to apply that and have that work out, I tell you right now, there is absolutely no way that hunt would have went the way it did had it not been for your podcast and all the guests that you've had on it. It's just a wealth of knowledge. It's unbelievable.
Wow, man,
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's super cool. What are some takeaways for others listening to this who are in a position where you were a year ago? I mean, obviously, unfortunately, we can't guarantee these results for everybody for first time. Yeah. But I mean, you've covered so much, so some of it may just be reiterating or reinforcing what you said in terms of what you've learned or lessons. But what are some of the other takeaways that you want to make sure we share with other listeners who are getting into elk hunting or, you know, still trying to find success, things like that?
Man, one thing is maps. Like I said, just the Onyx maps, Google Earth, and everybody's introduction on how to use them. Man, that's just such a valuable tool. I don't think you can spend enough time on maps. It gives you an idea of when I stepped out of the truck, I felt like I know where I was. I knew that once I crested this hill, I had another hill in front of me that was going to wrap around to the west. That's a big one. You know, go with your instincts. If you feel like you need something in your pack that's going to give you peace of mind, pack it, but know that it's going to be extra weight in your pack. But at the same time, you've got a condition mentally and physically, because it's big, it's big country. And, you know, the pack out of this elk, I've told everybody I've talked to, it was the most awesome suck that there ever was. It was, I don't know that I've ever enjoyed agony that much, but that was something that I'd wanted to do forever. But I don't think you can condition enough for it. And I'm not talking about being fit. I'm not talking about being super healthy and slamming energy drinks and everything else. I'm talking about putting weight on your back and walking stairs. You cannot do that enough. Whether you're going to hunt a mile or 2 miles, if you're going to pack a 900 pound elk out of the woods, you've got to have your legs under you for sure. And that's another thing. I've been fortunate enough now to actually put my hands on an XO pack, and that's one of my biggest regrets, having not researched my packs more. My pack did very well. I was pleased with my pack, but at the same time, you put your hands on your gear, especially your big items. That's because that mm-hmm. your pack makes or breaks you for sure. For sure.
Yeah, we say it over and over. Packs and boots, man. Those are the two yep. things you don't skimp on. There's a, you know, sleeping bag and tent. You can get away with a $100 thing or a Walmart sleeping bag, but pack and boots, they can make or break a hunt for sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I guess more than anything is just identify your limitations. Don't push too far, because it is big country, and you know you can. You can get too big for your britches really easy out there. And fortunately enough, we didn't run into hardly anybody else out there, so we didn't feel pressured to have to get away from people. But just identify your limitations and be honest with yourself, because it's not a big bad macho deal. Like I said, you don't have to be 6 miles in to kill an elk and have an awesome adventure for sure.
Awesome, man. Yeah. Couldn't recap it better. Great myself. Story. Yeah, Brian, thank you so much for sharing.
Absolutely. I was getting all excited just listening to your talking about the, you know, you got two bulls right in front of you and they're fighting each other, and that's amazing for me to experience it, and that's in my backyard and I get to experience it a lot. For you to come all the way out here and have that you had just the hair on the back of your neck had been standing up. That's so cool.
It was surreal. I was. Yeah. It was a jaw-dropping experience for sure.
That's awesome.
Well, Brian, once again, thanks for joining us. It was so much fun not only to learn from your experience, but also, again, as Steve just mentioned, just to hear it. It's just such a cool story. Memories that I'm sure will stick with you till the end.
Well, man, I appreciate the opportunity for sure. It's been an honor. And like I said, I encourage anybody, man, get on the podcast and start at the bottom and go up. I've spent hours. I've got a 30-minute commute each day, and I've listened to, I don't know if I've listened to all 104 or 5, whatever there are now, but I guarantee I've got 95 or 96 under my belt. And it's just, it's great information. It really is. And
all right. Again, guys, thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to shoot us that email to podcast@exomountaingear.com if you have any suggestions or questions. As well, that review on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen to us. If you can leave a review, do that. It helps us tremendously. Finally, if you've stuck around this far, hopefully you've already heard in previous episodes about the training plan that we have with Atomic Athlete. If you guys want to get in shape for the backcountry, go check out exomountaingear.com/train, 100% free, a great resource for you guys.